or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
4616, get in the mix, stir the batter. Constant chatter on CKUT 90.3 FM. Did I miss something?
BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chojage, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, March 31st, 2022. On tonight's show, I meet a Francophone director eager to bring his sci-fi adaptation to an English audience, and two choreographers who see their audiences as witnesses and participants in their art. My guests tonight meet Kayan Quealy, the founder of Montreal's own stepping troupe, and how the rhythmic dance form was born through the fight for freedom and community.
I thought it was so fascinating, I thought it was so interesting what they were doing, the rhythms they were creating. And then I said, I want to learn. I joined the team. I joined the choir. I would go on to take over the step team. One thing I focus on all the time is that I didn't realize that stepping would have connected me to part of my ancestors' history, part of my history that I was not aware of.
Another dance master, choreographer Sashar Zarif, brings his new show Kismet to the Mai.
When we have limitations, we just use creativity as a tool, as a catalyst, but not as an approach to find our way. Our way will be revealed through intuitive self-discovery and inwardness and outwardness at the same time.
And director and designer Cédric Delorme-Bouchard on bringing a sci-fi novel set on a spaceship to the stage.
Science fiction is often used in the cinema, TV series, but it's not often that we start from those kind of literature to create theater or dance project. It's really an unusual choice.
A very big thank you to everyone who contributed to CKUT's funding drive. It wrapped up on Sunday. Thank you if you contributed to Upstage's personal fundraising goal. I'll be getting in touch with you to let you know about how you can collect your prize. And thank you so much to the theaters who contributed something as a special incentive to raise money for Upstage and CKUT, Mainline Theater and the Montreal Saint-Ambroise Fringe Festival, Centaur Theater, Siegel Center, and Infinitheater, who, by the way, we're going to be covering all the shows they've donated tickets to in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned. On with our show. Kayan Quealy was born in St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean, and while he was studying in the U.S., he discovered an art form, a form of percussive dancing known as stepping. In it, the body becomes an instrument to create sound and rhythm. Rooted within the African-American fraternities and sororities in the U.S., it draws on African traditions on storytelling and call and response. The performances are energizing and mesmerizing, and as Kayan soon learned, as much about community and pride as performance. As Kayan will further explain, his life soon brought him to Montreal, where he founded Montreal Steppers just 3 years ago, building off an existing cornerstone Afro-Canadian group in Montreal. And the troupe brings their work not only to the community, but to students of all levels from elementary to university. This weekend, Montreal Steppers is presenting a new show, The Route to Canada, at the Siegel Center. There are two performances on Saturday, 4 and 8 p.m., and I'm giving away tickets for both performances. Please email me your time preference, your name, and your phone number at upstage@ckut.ca by 10 a.m. tomorrow, Friday, April 1st, and I will confirm if you've won your tickets by end of day. Kayan Quealy wrote The Route to Canada. He is the founder and the director of Montreal Steppers. I spoke with him earlier this week. Welcome, Kayan, to Upstage. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm super excited to be here with you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our upcoming show.
Tell me about your journey to stepping. How did you come to this dance form?
Well, I'm going to go back to when I was in university. So I left St. Kitts when I was 22. I was born and raised in the Federation of St. Kitts Nevis, which is in the Caribbean, beautiful island. And I went to school in upstate New York, so just in Plattsburgh, which is across the border from Canada. And while I was in university, I saw a gospel choir group, and that was the Plattsburgh State Gospel Choir, and they had a step team. So while attending the concert, the choir sang, and then the step team stepped, and they performed. I had seen stepped on television before, different movies, Stomp the Yard, and different things, but it was my first time pretty much.
Good evening, it's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on Thursday, April 7th, And we're going to do some things a little differently tonight. Waiting for many big theater productions to open up later this month, with shows from Black Theater Workshop, Centaur, Siegel, and Infinitheater, to name a few. And I'll take you behind the scenes of those productions over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, I've got some different kinds of arts goings on to share with you. I'll speak again with musician Norman Navratsky, who is organizing a fundraiser for relief efforts in Ukraine and Poland.
Many of us have not played for 2.5 years for good reasons, because of COVID. That we're coming together for this particular purpose kind of invests it with a special magic for us, that we know we're playing for an amazing cause and that this money is going directly to people in need now.
And a special treat, Aussie rocker Nick Cave was in town this weekend to perform and also open a biographical exhibit, a fascinating show whether or not you're familiar with his genre-bending rock with his bands like The Birthday Party and The Bad Seeds.
There's a lot of reasons to be happy at the moment, especially a band on tour, because by that stage, well, apart from anything, we've managed to get through now two tours of one of England and some of Europe and one of North America without catching COVID.
We'll hear from the woman who sorted through boxes and boxes of Nick Cave's ephemera to produce this show. We'll also take a moment to remember the life of Boris Brot. You might remember hearing from musician Norman Navratsky on the show late last year. He had created a one-man show on the internment of Ukrainian immigrants to Canada during World War I. Seen as foreign agents, it was a brutal move that left many new arrivals to Canada living in squalid camps across the country. Some of them didn't survive the experience, and we're talking children, families, older people as well. It's a bit of a stain on the Canadian history. Norman is a theater maker based in Montreal, and he has family still back in Ukraine and at home. He is organizing a concert tomorrow night, Sunday, April the 8th, at La Sala Rosa to raise money for an organization on the ground at the Ukraine-Polish border. It's an eclectic mix of folk, classical, and klezmer music, including Ukrainian pianist Serhiy Salov, singer Olga Kotyar-Lemeshko, violinist Mariusz Monchak. And you're hearing some of the music from Norman's band, Dazok, here. They'll be performing as well, 16 artists total. Over 4 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia launched an invasion at the end of February. Many of them have flocked to the Polish border in the west, seeking refuge. Tickets are going fast for the benefit concert, but Norman says this is just the first of many shows to come. I spoke with Norman earlier today. Welcome back to Upstage, Norman. Thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be back with you, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
You're here not because of something positive necessarily. Obviously, everyone is following what's happening in Ukraine. It's painful, whether you have a connection to the region or not, to see what's going on. But for you, it is personal, because when we spoke in December, you were talking a lot about your Ukrainian roots and your family and how they came to Canada. So tell me about your history, your family history with that region.
I guess it's 122 years now since my family emigrated from Ukraine, from southwestern Ukraine to Canada. So 122 years later, and my family came 122 in 1900. Yeah, 1900, the family emigrated to Canada. And they came here because they were suffering from poverty. They were hungry. They were oppressed by the landlords that were, you know, dominant in Ukraine at that moment. The Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they came to Canada. And now 122 years later, and Ukrainians are coming to Canada again, but this time it's because of the war. So.
And how does this feel for you to be seeing your ancestral land? You know, just the images we saw come out this weekend shows that civilians are being killed. We've seen bombed out images of towns like Mariupol. Like it just seems like there's nothing good coming out of it. It's hard to be optimistic. And for you to have that history, it must be painful.
It's painful because of the history. It's also painful because of the present, that I have still family there and friends, which I, you know, discovered like a few years ago, just before COVID in 2017, I was in Ukraine visiting and stumbled on family members. It's like, oh my God, they're still around. So this is fantastic. So we stayed in touch all that time. And I have friends there as well, who I met in Ukraine. I made friends when I was there visiting, and we stayed in touch all this time. So as soon as the war broke out, I was in immediate contact with both family and friends. Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I've been in touch like every couple of days just to get news updates. So for the moment, knock on wood, they're safe, but it's really scary. Some of them are working with refugee groups, helping resettle refugees within Ukraine, helping get refugees out of Ukraine. Others are cooking, nonstop cooking, day and night, to feed people fighting on the front lines. And others are debating, do they pick up a gun and go on the front line? And these are like teachers, artists, you know, young people, professionals, the sweetest people like you, you know, who has a radio program, and then you're going to pick up a gun and go out there, and you've never fired a gun in your life, and you're going to try and defend your country. So yeah, it's been stressful. It's been very difficult. But I also have family in Poland on the other side of the border, and they're freaked out because they have no idea what's going to happen. Will they be next in the bullseye? And they're also working with refugees, helping receive people, helping resettle people. Anyway, so there's quite a connection. I have a connection, yes, an immediate connection with Ukraine.
And I hope you can continue to stay in touch with so many people. I just saw an image of a really badly affected area where there's just a table full of power bars and there's a ton of cables, like a jumble of cables, because everyone's plugging in their phones to stay in touch with loved ones, both, you know, in the country, in the area, but of course around the world as well. And it's hard to also just convey that I think the saber rattling has obviously been a long time coming, but 2 months ago, these friends of yours who were just leading ordinary lives, right?
Completely. We were in touch. It's like, oh, I'm doing this new project. Oh, I'm doing this. And we had plans. I had plans with my sister before COVID hit to go back to do shows, to do tours. We were going to visit so-and-so here and so there. We're going to bring them this. We were planning the gifts to bring in. You know, all in our minds, we were planning this out. And COVID hit. And we're like, okay, we'll wait a while longer and then we'll go. We'll see everybody. They were excited we were coming. We were going to organize a tour and play music, because I play music with my sister as a duo. We were going to play our Canadian-Ukrainian music for them. And then the war happened. And it's like, okay, we're not going. And they might even be coming here. You know, I mean, we're preparing that to receive family or friends. And I'm putting it out to them. If you want to come to Canada, there are these programs. And it's just like, but it's the unthinkable. Because one of them has a son who's fighting in the army now. And she's not going to leave at all. And the others have friends and loved ones also fighting in the army. And they don't want to leave. So we don't know. We just don't know. Too many, there's a lot of unknown.
I'm so sorry. This must be just so agonizing for you. But Norman, you, like so many other Ukrainian Canadians and other Canadians as well, you're not sitting still and you're doing something to help. So I'm speaking with Norman Novrotsky, who's a Montreal-based musician with a lot of ancestry back in Ukraine and Poland, as you've been talking about. Tell me about tomorrow night's show.
Music for Ukraine, Music for the Ukraine. Is a show I pull together of Ukrainian musicians, Polish musicians, other East European, Latvian musicians, because I wanted to showcase music of East Europe, music of Ukraine, and I want it to be presented by East European artists who play it, who know it, who live it. And so I'm organizing a benefit tomorrow at the Sala. Doors open 6:30, showtime 7:30. Tickets are selling very quickly. So if anybody wants to get into the Sala tomorrow, you better buy your ticket today, tonight, now. And there'll be 16 musicians in solo acts, duos, trios, and band formation. The music will range from classical to klezmer to folk to traditional, a bit of opera, songs sung in Ukrainian. We have world-famous classical pianists playing with us, world-rated violinists playing with us. It's going to be quite an eclectic evening of music, but you know, guaranteed that you're going to hear amazing, you know, music on the stage of the Sala tomorrow night, and it's for a good cause.
Of course. And the money is raised is going to go to an organization that happens to be on the ground right now, I think on both sides of the Polish-Ukrainian border. Can you tell me about this foundation?
Yeah, it's called Folkowisko Foundation. And it actually started out as a mom and pop's bed and breakfast. That's how I know them, the people there, that I was going to visit them because other friends had visited, stayed with them and said, Norman, you got to go check them out. They're so cool. They're on the border. They got this neat bed and breakfast. It's in the mountains. It's surrounded by nature. They have this agro-tourism, you know, thing that they offer to visitors. So it was on my list of, okay, that's where we're going to go. We're going to go there. We'll stay there. We'll play there. We'll have a wonderful time there before the war. So the war happened. They opened their B&B to refugees who were streaming across the border. So there were six people the first night, then there were 12, then there were 20, then there were 30. And they're like, whoop, okay, we got to do something. So given that they have experience as music festival organizers, you think of any alternative music festival in Montreal or alternative theater festival, they're our kind of people. So given they have that experience and all the connections, they immediately set up this incredible network of tents to house and feed people, transportation. They organized rides to transport people from the border to points, safe points beyond. They organized medical services to treat people who needed it immediately, whether it was, you know, injuries needed treated or just counseling. They fed people, they housed people, and then they started trucking supplies into Ukraine into towns that had no food, had no water, had no medicine, had no blankets. And then they started bringing books into Ukraine, or bringing books back from Ukraine into Poland for all the refugee kids, because they came with just little backpacks. They didn't bring their toys or books or anything. So they brought back, they bring back books from Ukraine for the refugees, for the kids, so they have books. Anyway, they've mounted this huge humanitarian organization staffed by volunteers, hundreds of volunteers who've come from around the world. People have flown there from Colombia, from Vancouver, from, you know, from China, to work with them on the border. So it's this international volunteer initiative working with people, trucking stuff in and getting people out. And it's phenomenal. So we're raising money for them.
And they do have Montreal connections. There was a big concert in March that raised money that held, it was a sold out show at the Notre Dame Basilica. It looked like an absolutely wonderful event. Some of the musicians there are going to be with you tomorrow night at La Sala Rosa. I'm speaking with Norman Navratsky, Montreal-based musician, gathering a whole smattering of musicians together for tomorrow night to raise money to support refugee aid in Ukraine. Some of them include Serhiy Selhov, who is Ukrainian, I believe. He's a wonderful pianist.
World famous, world caliber. I mean, my friends elsewhere in Canada go, oh my God, you got him to play at the show. He's phenomenal.
Yeah. And to see him in an intimate venue like La Sala Rosa, I think will be quite an exceptional experience. Mariusz Monczak, who I believe is Polish. And is that correct?
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, another world-class violinist.
And I actually spoke with his daughter recently, who, after doing said concert at the Basilica, had actually headed to work with the foundation in Europe before doing some tours herself. And what are you planning to play tomorrow night, Norman?
I'm going to do a solo piece to begin with. I'll open the evening show with a solo piece, playing a traditional Ukrainian piece with a video I want to show as well. And then I'll be playing with my band, Dezok, where the five-piece string ensemble will be playing Ukrainian East European music. There's also the Bag Street Klezmer Band, who, like us, hasn't played for like 2.5 years, played a live show, so it's wonderful to play again. Then there's a Ukrainian band called Bozonish, and they're like an alternative rock band. There's the Ukrainian folk singer Olga Kotlier-Lemeshko, who's a wonderful, wonderfully talented like Ukrainian folk singer. Vytautas Bučonis, who's a Lithuanian pianist who plays all kinds of stuff. He's absolutely fabulous. And then Steve Masakot is another world-class pianist playing with Marina Marivka. So it's going to be a wonderful show.
There's such a symbolism that you and so many of these bands or musical groups are reuniting. You know, we're still in the middle of the pandemic, that's for sure, but still coming together after such a long pause in order to raise awareness and to raise money for people who really, really need it.
Many of us have not played for 2.5 years for good reasons because of COVID. That we're coming together for this particular purpose kind of invests it with a special magic for us, that we know we're playing for an amazing cause and that this money's going directly to people in need now. You know, what can we do? Because, you know, I was fretting. What do we do? What do we do? This war is taking place over there and I'm over here safe in Canada. What do we do? What do we do? Let's raise money. I mean, as an artist, as a musician, that's the first thing that came to mind. And this is probably going to be the first of many fundraising efforts that will happen like down the road, because unfortunately, sadly, it's going to be needed. And I know Ukraine, it's a poor country to begin with, you know? It's not as bad as Afghanistan. When the Americans bombed Afghanistan, it was already dirt poor and they bombed it into the Stone Age. But the Russians are transforming Ukraine into what was a viable economy, a wonderful, wonderful place to be, into a bit of a wasteland, the cities especially. And who knows what's going to happen in the fields. I read an interesting quote from a farmer, Ukrainian farmer, who picked up a gun and was a soldier. And he said, God damn it, we got to end this war soon because we got to get out there and plant potatoes. And these are my people. Like, my family were peasant farmers in Ukraine. They were peasant farmers in Canada. And that's the mentality. Like, let's get this stuff over with and so we can get back to the basics, which is planting food to feed people.
Because when they say that Ukraine is the breadbasket of the world or of Europe, I mean, I was looking into it and learning that it is 100% true. And not only that, but the impacting the agricultural season process in Ukraine right now is actually also affecting the food aid programs that the UN operates in countries where food is not as readily available. So the grains that should be coming out of Ukraine right now or later this summer, they're not going to the people around the world who actually need them as well, which is just such a tragic coda to all of this.
Absolutely, completely. And it's some of my cousins are able to eat because they have gardens. They have like farmland, they have gardens, they're able to eat. But they're donating, using all that food to feed other Ukrainians now. You know, normally it would go for sale in the market. Instead, they're donating all that food to make the pierogies, the cabbage rolls, the soup, the bread, to feed people who now have absolutely no food. No food, no water, no electricity, no nothing. It's difficult to wrap our minds around it. I look out the window and, people are in their cars and their bicycles. Montreal life is as it always has been. And so one of the challenges now is how do we maintain interest in this ongoing war, like all these other wars going on around the world, and support people who need it? And how do we fight that concept of war itself so it doesn't repeat itself over and over again? How do we get people to lay down their arms? How do we get the Russians to lay down their arms and the Americans, people elsewhere? This is just an ongoing fight to stop war. War is not the solution. There has to be a negotiated peace. There has to be talking. There has to be, some give and take. Anyway, it's challenging, and for the moment, all we can do is play music and raise money.
And I don't mean to be facetious, but in a weird way, gathering together, playing music, hearing music in its own right is part of the healing process. We know that there's people overseas who are in a way worse situation than we are, but it is an anxiety-inducing time for many people here, whether you have a personal connection or not, but at least you'll be able to bring some respite with this concert.
Well, it's bringing people together, and that's what my cousin also said about Ukraine, that the war has brought people together. The war brought people together to share food, to share clothing, to share housing. And, one friend in one city said she gave up her apartment because a family needed it more than she did. She could stay with her boyfriend at his apartment. So, there's a tremendous sense, like the humanity that's in us has a chance to shine sometimes in moments of extreme, need. And even here in Montreal, I'm meeting people I never knew before in the Ukrainian community who've come together, bring together money, food, clothing, everything else to help those in need. War brings out the best and the worst in people. And so the best is for us in Montreal, bring musicians together, bring Ukrainians together. How are we going to support the people back there? So it's a positive, wonderful thing to see and experience. And, we just have to continue that process. And
Norman, I'm so glad that you're doing this, and I wish you all the best of continued success with this fundraiser and the many other ones to follow. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was musician Norman Navrotsky organizing and performing at a benefit concert tomorrow night, Friday, April 8th at La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint-Laurent. His band Dazok will be performing. You're hearing some of their music here. And the lineup includes Ukrainian pianist Serhii Salov, the Bag Street Klezmer Band, singer Olga Kotyar-Lemeshko, violinist Mariusz Monchak, among many others. A wide variety of genres here. We're talking folk, rock music, ambient, klezmer, classical, and more. Tickets are $20 in advance or $30 at the door, and they are going fast. You want to visit the pointofsale.com website for your tickets. You can also look this up on Facebook. It's titled Music for Ukraine, and as I mentioned, it's happening at La Sala Rosa. And if you don't get a chance to see this show, Norman says he is planning more fundraisers to come. Proceeds will go to the Foco Visco Foundation. As you heard Norman explain earlier, they are coordinating support for refugees fleeing Ukraine into Poland. You can visit them online. I'm going to spell out the website for you, folkowisko.graje.info. I'm Sarah DeA. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation. Nick Cave was born and raised in a small company town in rural Australia. Sent to study as a teenager at boarding school, he started to explore music and played in punk rock bands. Eventually, he made the move to London with his crew to launch their musical careers. From his first band, The Boys Next Door, to The Birthday Party, to his most iconic lineup, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Nick's work has become synonymous with energetic, charismatic, scene-shoeing performances, an obsession with the New Testament, sin, doubt, and anger. He's a lanky, pale figure with wild black locks. And of course, even the most hardened rock musician mellows out with age, though they can usually still put on a good show. Nick Cave is now 64 years old, and that's just what he did this past weekend, playing two shows to audiences at Place des Arts, closing out his latest world tour. But in addition to writing and performing music, he's also written books and scripts, so he is an artist. He studied drawing as a young student, and so he's a multifaceted guy. A new show in town peels back the layers of Nick Cave's persona and his upbringing with hundreds of pieces of ephemera from his life, from choir photos in his early days, to homemade books he made when he was living in Berlin, to the strange locks of hair he bought from an antiquary shop when he was living in Berlin. This is a biographical show called Stranger Than Kindness. It opens tomorrow at a gallery in the Quartier des Spectacles. It has traveled from Copenhagen, Denmark, where it originally opened in spring 2020 at the Royal Danish Library. That is where Victor Schiffman saw the show back in 2019. He was in town in Copenhagen just ahead of the actual opening. Victor was there to open up his show, A Crack in Everything, which was the Leonard Cohen-inspired art exhibit where they had several artists come up with tributes to Cohen and his work. Victor would be instrumental in bringing this Cave show to Cohen's hometown of Montreal. And of course, there is a deeper connection there, which you'll find out about more in a moment. This past Tuesday, I was invited with other journalists to question Nick Cave in a room that is basically a recreation of his home office. The curators filled up and carted away boxes and boxes of Nick's furniture, books, notes, and photographs, and they recreated it very lovingly, painstakingly, in this space in the midway point of the exhibit. So there's stacks of books everywhere. There are notes on the walls, photographs, musical instruments strewn all over the place. There's a typewriter on the desk. And so at the start, we're all seated, facing in one direction towards his office, waiting for him. And he enters into the room and says, "What are you all doing in my office?" And that's when the questions started. We had about 50 minutes to speak with him. And at some point throughout, I was listening to the questions and his very interesting answers. And I also realized that he was referring a lot to, you know, being self-absorbed earlier on in his life and work, which is maybe not a surprising thing for an internationally successful artist, but it sounded like he was referring to this in the past tense. So I asked him about this period of self-absorption and what caused him to eventually zoom out over time.
Well, I just think that when you're younger, especially when you do art, there's just an assumption that's made that the art is everything. It is what it's all about. And the life of the artist is this sort of something, this exalted state, like this great state. And it's just the way it is that everything else suffers as a consequence. Your relationships with your children, or your wife, or your friends, or just your involvement in the world as a citizen, let's say, even. And I just think I found out the hard way, actually, that there were other things more important to me than the creative experience. That's not to say that my life isn't just absolutely blowing out in all directions with work, creatively. There's so much going on at the moment, it's just ridiculous. But I just feel more I just think when you're on your deathbed or something like that, maybe the fact that I wrote The Mercy Seat may not be the most important thing that my wife's sitting with me and I say, "Darling, I have something to tell you. I wrote The Mercy Seat." I just think there's other things. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's other things when you walk through the door. That I think that's what this exhibition is trying to say. The exhibition is room to room, a series of kind of ruptures, things that from the childhood and being sort of sent off to the city to go to school and the whole birthday party thing that goes on and then the Berlin years, all of these were a series of collapsing states of being, let's say. Collapsing ideologies of jumping from one to the next, and that that nothing feels very stable in that way. But there's something through that door that feels to me more stable, and that's, I think, my family, my wife, my children. Friends.
Another writer in the room asked him about Nick Cave's current state of mind, and he touched on what it has been like for him to tour during COVID. I thought his answer was quite meditative.
Well, there's a lot of reasons to be happy, there's a lot of reasons to be happy at the moment, especially a band on tour, because by that stage, well, apart from anything, we've managed to get through now two tours of one of England and some of Europe and one of North America without catching COVID. This is actually quite astonishing. We don't really... I mean, the first tour, we took a lot of... We did it in a kind of COVID bubble and we didn't allow ourselves to sort of see many people and stuff like that. But this tour has been... We haven't really followed any protocol at all. And we were very surprised that we managed to get through this tour without catching COVID. Because as soon as someone catches COVID, you have to shut the tour down, right? There's no one will insure the tours. It's a very dangerous thing to go out on tour these days. But we feel it's so it's a special moment to be on tour, because I think audiences are learning how to be audiences again. There's a certain feeling of jeopardy, like a certain feeling of danger within the audience to sit there in a group of people within a pandemic. So there's a joyful aspect of that, of just being able to go on stage and make music. But on a personal level, I just feel much happier, I think, these days than I ever have. And I've just found a way of arriving at that in some kind of way. And I think that kind of happiness has been hard won, or it's an earned happiness, shall we say. I think that just comes from just a valuing of things, a valuing of getting up on stage and playing your music and being surrounded by friends and playing it to people who've come along to see it, that these are special moments and joyful moments. You know, that's how I feel about things these days in general, really. I think that's a getting older thing too. You just cut away some of the stuff that's unnecessary. And I don't know. Anyway, it was a huge privilege to be on stage and to play a concert to everyone. That's how we're feeling. And it's such a, in my view, such a beautiful, very moving, very personal, very intimate, vulnerable concert. I love to look at Warren. Warren's just kind of in heaven, sitting there with his little synthesizer, you know, and the beautiful singers, and it's quite something.
Reference there to his longtime collaborator, Warren Ellis, who was on stage this weekend. Now, you have to keep in mind as well that we were sitting in this big space, which is decorated like Nick Cave's office. There's photographs, there's stacks and stacks of books and instruments and furniture, books by Nabokov, Germaine Greer, and John Berryman. There are tomes on religion, history, and poetry. And one eagle-eyed reporter noticed a Leonard Cohen album was set up on a turntable. So he asked Nick about his connection to Cohen.
When I was, I think, about 14 years old in Australia, in growing up in a country town, or I'd actually had left this country town, but I'd gone back because my parents still lived there. They'd sent me off to Melbourne, but I came back one summer and for the holidays, and I had a friend there who was slightly older than me, Anne Baumgarten, the girl, and she had a back room in her house, and she said, "Come here." And so I went to this room, and she had all kind of cardboard on the windows. It was very dark and all this stuff, and she said, "Listen to this," and she put on Songs of Love and Hate, which is there. It's in a way that's all through this exhibition are little recreations of important moments. We don't make a big deal out of it, but that's why Leonard Cohen is there on the turntable. And I was just a weird kid growing up in a Australian country town, feeling like I didn't really fit in, feeling like I didn't really relate to the same things that people related to in this small country town. And just heard Avalanche, the first song, come out, Leonard Cohen's voice, and this was just a seismic change for me. Suddenly, I felt that feeling of being understood by somebody, and that this voice became like a voice of a friend that sort of followed me around for the rest of my career, really. You put on a Leonard Cohen record, some I like more than others, but there was always that the tone of his voice was always listening to a wise friend, and that's how it was a huge moment for me to hear Leonard Cohen, to hear that song, and to understand that there was something else that put a name to my own particular feelings of anguish and anger and so on. I love that first record more than any other record.
Later on, Nick Cave actually revealed that Leonard Cohen had emailed him in the wake of the accidental death of one of Nick's twin teenage boys. Arthur was 14 or 15. He fell from a cliff near their home in Brighton a few years ago, and Leonard Cohen had written him a one-line email: "Dear Nick, I am with you, brother." And you can actually see that email in one of the exhibit rooms that follow the office. Now, I want to bring in Christina Bach, who is the woman we can credit for this exhibit. The Copenhagen-based curator actually approached Nick Cave to create the show a few years ago. She and her team, as I mentioned, hauled out boxes and boxes of his belongings and archives and sorted through them to find the stray correspondence, photos, drawings, lyrics scrawled on scraps of paper, many mementos, and she made order out of it. She is in Montreal, of course, to set up the show, and I got to speak with her at the office. I first asked Christina about bringing the exhibit to Montreal from Copenhagen.
So interesting to put it up here in Montreal. And as I said, and that was really true, because this is the first version of the touring exhibition. We were really a little bit nervous about how this would turn up in a new space, how sensitive the spaces would be to the changes. I mean, of course, the space is different compared to the Copenhagen exhibition. But I mean, we managed to sort of have the right flow, and it's just lovely really to see it all come together. And the people that we had, like a whole Copenhagen team coming in, and they were like, oh my God, it looks completely like Copenhagen. So even though that we're twisting things and we're updating the exhibition, there's still a sort of continuous feel to the whole thing that is here, and that's just really wonderful to see that have been possible.
Now, initially, when Christina had approached Nick, well, you know, his team, to gauge interest in doing a show like this, she was actually told, quote, thanks but no thanks. But he did eventually come around, so I asked her about how satisfying it was to have your wild idea get the green light and go ahead.
First of all, looking at where we are now, this is beyond what I have imagined. I have always worked with very sort of sensuous, immersive, multi-sensuous experience-based exhibitions. But this is beyond anything I hope for. This is beyond what I proposed in the beginning, because this Nick have been so involved in this, and this allowed us to completely blow the boundaries of what an exhibition could be like, because it takes, you know, Nick is both the co-creator and then he's the artist, and he holds all the stories. So normally when you make a biographical exhibition, you would lean towards telling the truth and things like that, but with Nick on board, the exhibition vibrates between biography and fiction, basically, because he can push his story and open them up in a way that we could never do ourselves, and that have just been amazing.
Without his participation, it would have been different.
Nothing. We would never have been able to do that. And I would also say I wasn't expecting that he would dive into this on this level. But that was, of course, I mean, we worked on it together for 2 years. It's a journey of creating some kind of trust, yes, that allows this, yeah, to happen, a mutual respect for each other, and then things start to grow, and that have just been really wonderful to experience, I must say.
So what does it take to be a curator in a show about the oeuvre and life of a great artist? What does that job entail? I asked Christina that.
The skills that I bring to the table is the exhibition making skills. But what actually turned out to be one of the biggest surprises is that Nick just had a really, really good sense about these things. You know, he went to art school before he became a musician, and I didn't know that when I reached out to him. So I think that this way of working visually with storytelling has always been with him. So actually, where I was expecting that I had to guide him more, of course it's a collaboration, yeah. But often it was also a question about me stepping back and allow his idea to emerge, and then of course use my experience to bring them into life. But it was really interesting, this part about stepping back and giving him a space, because he found his own way in of actually working with the exhibition, and that was just very wonderful to see.
I also could not help but notice that Nick, during his remarks to the press, said he felt like his life was boring, a feeling he believes his idol, Leonard Cohen, also identified with, that their lives just weren't that interesting. And yet here we are, essentially in a massive myth-making exercise. So how do you square that feeling about yourself while also working on this show? I asked Christina about that, and here she gets a little more into the essence of the project itself.
I guess that's why he was not really that interested in the beginning, because he wasn't interested in telling that story, but I think the exhibition goes beyond that story. I think in the end he also said that it has become a thing on its own right. It's not just a holder of stuff. It's a artistic expression, just happens to be in space. And I think that's how it became something completely different, and it's not about the life that he might think is boring. Well, I think it's very interesting, yes. Though. But I understand that's not interesting for him to dive into. But this is, because this is opening up towards ideas and shared reflection on who we are and what makes us who we are, and that's a different kind of community to step into, and it's not just looking at one person. It's something that we can all relate to.
That was Christina Bach, the curator of Stranger Than Kindness, the Nick Cave exhibition. It opens tomorrow at La Galerie de la Maison du Festival. You have until August 7th to check it out. This is in the building that houses the venue L'Astral, 305 St. Catherine Street West. For more info, 514-288-8882 or visit montrealjazzfest.com. Past the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand. Wrap you in his arms, tell you that you've been a good boy. He'll rekindle all the dreams that took you a lifetime to destroy.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, I have to take a moment to remember a member of the Montreal music scene who has been making connections and performing for decades, part of a classical music dynasty, actually, in the city. Boris Brott was the artistic director and conductor at the Orchestre Classique de Montréal. This was actually an orchestra that was founded by his parents many years ago. Alexander and Lottie Brott were the founders of the McGill Chamber Orchestra, which was the original name of the organization. His brother, Dennis, was also a very celebrated cellist who was based here. He had a near-death experience with COVID-19 very early on in the pandemic. Well, the music community was stunned to learn that Boris was killed earlier this week. He went out for a walk on Tuesday. He was struck by a motorist in a hit and run.
the person has been apprehended. It is under investigation by the police. There were reports that they were driving erratically. It is a stunning close to a remarkable life and has, I think, shocked the musical community and sent everyone into mourning. He was also director of Hamilton's National Academy Orchestra of Canada. He operated the Brat Music Festival. He was a member of the Order of Canada and the Order of Quebec. And though he was 78 years old, he had the energy of someone, you know, a third of that age. I spoke with him myself over the years for a few interviews. Most recently, we had spoken with him in December when they had performed a Christmas concert at St. Joseph's Oratory. He was anticipating to play later this month in a fundraiser for the Ukrainian new humanitarian efforts on April 20th. That was going to be in Vancouver. The show is actually going to go on in his memory. And the Orchestre Classique de Montréal is also, their next event actually is for later this month as well. And I believe it is still going ahead. He was a very warm person. He also used music as a way to build ties within communities. He commissioned work by Indigenous artists and highlighted that music with his Orchestre Classique here in Montreal. And because, you know, when something like this happens, it's so sudden, it really is hard to reckon with the senselessness of it and the fact that he was a busy person with a very full spring ahead. It's hard to absorb that. But the best way to pay homage to someone like that is to continue playing music, enjoying music. So I invite you to go to the Orchestre Classique de Montréal's website, check out their events coming up this spring, because they are going to, they still have a full slate of events planned. This year, for their, I think, 82nd year, they were focusing on women, actually. So highlighting the achievements of women who had been in the orchestra and women who currently play within the orchestra, and paying homage to his own mother, Lottie, who, as I mentioned, co-founded the original version of the orchestra way back when, with his father, Alexander. And you can also go to the YouTube page of the Orchestre Classique de Montréal, where there are panel discussions and performances. You can see Boris conducting. I'm going to play for you here, actually, Handel's Messiah from that December concert just last year, a Christmas concert that he oversaw. So it's not something you would normally hear here on Upstage, but this is Handel's Messiah, conducted by Boris Brat, the artistic director and conductor of the Orchestre Classique de Montréal, who died on Tuesday in a hit and run in Hamilton, Ontario.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Thank you.
come to play. CKUT is having a funding drive. CKUT is your community radio supporting events, culture, and shows, and playing the music you wouldn't even know you liked unless you heard it here. Give us a call, 514-907-9424, and give what you can.
The sound of this doorbell may seem pretty ordinary to you, until you realize that it's Graham, who's 75 years old and still delivering meals to people in need in his neighborhood. And that for many of them, it's the most comforting sound they'll hear all day. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Just say that the Reuters bureau chief worked tirelessly to get the collateral murder video and the military light. They said they didn't have it, they couldn't find it, and then we only saw it when Chelsea Manning very courageously gave it to WikiLeaks to publish. Until that time, the narrative that the military had spun out about that incident was a complete fiction. It was a lie.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges. Truth is the first